This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is January 4th, 1994. I'm here for our a third interview with Professor Max Bäumer, from the formerly of the German Department. And today we're going to be talking about your research here at the university. You mentioned a little bit last time before about your dissertation research, but let's move now to your career here at Madison and the research you conducted.
Yes. I came here because the department, the German department, needed an expert on 15th, 16th century literature. Up to that, but I had actually two areas of research and scholarly interest. One, the 16th century, which means Renaissance, humanism, Renaissance and Reformation, as usually. And then the 18th century, emphasizing Enlightenment, Classicism, and beginning Romanticism. And then, as I had mentioned, particular interest has been the influence of antiquity and on early modern literature and philosophy. And the main authors I dealt with were Luther and Winckelmann, Hermann Heinze, Hölderlin, Goethe, and a little bit of Nietzsche. That was because of the Dionysian. My approach to these areas is rather realistic. I never followed a certain theory, let's say, of like neoclassicism or Marxism, or opposite of this. I think the reason that for my particular interest, being interested in reality, is due to the fact that I came to this profession rather late, and I was 42 years old when I got my dissertation, that my previous professional engagements were dealing with people. Mm-hmm. And so I always kept some distance to particular movements.
Did that ever end up getting you in trouble with, let's say, the Marxist or any different?
Well, with some of my colleagues who were confessing socialists or so. Especially with the ones of who came from Germany, who were always more involved. But the leading Marxist in the German department, an American, David Bathrick, who later left for, I think, John Hopkins, with him I had a very good rapport, because we both were rational and not emotional. And I asked myself, is literature important? Well, if literature is something like lovely poetry, interesting fiction and novels, and that's all, I wouldn't consider this as very important for real life. But my concept of literature, out of some other scholars, has been, literature is everything what is written down for either preserving or to giving it to your contemporaries or the ones who follow. Then also the fact, a discovery as a student already, that every important movement in our world was preceded by literary products dealing with this. And that is very obvious in the strong movements I had been dealing with, like Renaissance, Reformation, Enlightenment. Enlightenment ends in the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. And then comes to classicism and romanticism. And then we have a kind of a reactionary period of what they called restoration, the beginning of the 19th century. So all these movements which changed society and our thinking were prepared, had been prepared in literary products. So therefore, literature is important for every one of us, for the politician, for the educator. And so far, literature is a very important field. And that was my main argument for students, especially undergraduate students, to get them acquainted with literature. They have to take a course. For instance, in my capacity, I was supposed to teach it, a survey course of medieval and early modern literature, beginning from the beginning up to, let's say, the Renaissance, Reformation. Well, the student majoring in German had to take that course. What could his interest be? So that was then my beginning of teaching this. And then the second was then, of course, to show them, to demonstrate to them how philosophy and religion is an important part of the early centuries. And not religion as we see it today, something individual, which is just your own private affair, but religion as an ideology which dictates to a great extent what happens in politics. See, up to Enlightenment, there was no ideology apart from religion. Religion was the ideology. That is, the religion was not only something people went to and celebrated in church, but it directed not only their personal life, but also the life of the society, life of the state. The state would protect the church, because the church was the representative of the ideology. See, everybody was equal in that particular ideology. Therefore, religion was so important. But then when Enlightenment came, our rational attitude became important. Well, that's the birth of idea of individualism, what I think. But that very beginning of modern individualism is again in religion. It's Luther. Luther, who said, in order to be saved, you have to find your Savior, you have God in the Scripture. And when Luther was asked by followers, well, if I find a different Christ, a different God in the Scriptures, different from yours, then Luther said, then you have to follow this conception because it's yours. So, before that, the human being was a part of the church. The church was his home, was his family. If he had a question of belief, the church would tell him, like a father or mother would tell a child, this is the truth and you follow, and then you accept it. And of course, if you don't accept, then you not only go wrong individually, but you go wrong socially, politically. And you're outside of society. All this changes with the Enlightenment. And then from there on you have politics, political parties developing. Mm-hmm. So this is, that was actually the main line of my teaching, and which makes it fascinating to
Was that one of the main lines of your research as well?
Yeah. Research, modern research, I would say what I just said is the basis of my of research, but modern research goes more into specified, detailed investigation. Well, that was, as far as the 16th century is concerned, it was the impact of religion, Reformation, Renaissance, on the society. That was my actual line. And if I follow through my publications, then this is very obvious. Just see the first articles, human rights in Martin Luther's writing on the German nobility, social reforms in his writing on the nobility, problems of punishment in Martin Luther. Or going into the 18th century, the concept of utopia, a better society, the concept of an island utopia. As a matter of fact, when I retired in 1987, and the Institute decided, well, I must say this way, I told my colleagues in the department and Institute, I don't want a Festschrift, or something. Some friends of mine and students get together and write a big festive, and everybody writes something of what he just has in his drawer. And it's much of content and nothing, because there's no order. So I said, if you want to do something, then have a symposium. I said, well, that's good, but you give us the title, the topic. Well, I was thinking, what should I select? And one of my first publication when I came to this university was about utopia. And the last one in 1987 was about Thomas More's and utopia, and how his concept of utopia is reflected in the program of the American Alliance movement. So I gave these lectures on the Alliance, and they were, of course, flabbergasted to hear that they have a concept of Thomas More in the 16th century. So then Klaus Berkham, who had been an expert, had developed expertise on utopia, modern utopia particularly, he organized the symposium, and we had people from Europe and this country, and it was a great success. And again, it was the technical sides of utopia, not the fantastic attitude if somebody thinks something up which could exist on the moon, has no reality no real meaning for the reality of our social life. So, in other words, significance of literature in relation to society. That's probably, I think, one could determine this as the main object.
The thread that more or less connects all of your writings and your teachings.
So, even when I dealt with something like what they call topos, or topoi, These are commonplaces used in literature. Almost any ism, so to speak, romanticism, Marxism, socialism, they're thrown out and are used in different conceptions which change from generation to generation. So even my investigations in publishing a book and several articles on topoi, literary topoi, was proving that they have significance, a real significance, in using them in relation to reality. To reality. This attitude of mine, on one hand, was a limitation. You don't find any writing of me on poetry. I would be able to teach poetry, but I would not go into too much of details and particularities. Novels, yes, especially the ones who deal with reality in the society. But everything in literature related to society.
So you weren't as much interested in the language aspects, like in poetry, as you were to the societal aspects, which you would get in novels and essays and
that's right.
Things like that.
Even when I investigated expressions, which the Germans would lead back to Martin Luther, the concept of abundantia cordis, the fullness of heart. It's a concept which developed in Psalms and religious writings. And one particular, and Luther would go out of his way in translating these general terms into something in German would be closer to reality. So very famous and a very famous writing of Martin Luther is when he translates the Catholic Hail Mary. Hail Mary, Ave Maria. He said, you cannot say Hail Mary. What does that mean? What does the Bible say? The Bible says an angel appeared and greeted Mary with Hail Mary. How would he have done this in German? He would have said, Grüß Gott, like the southern Germans, barbarians and so would say, Grüß Gott, Maria. And then he would and then he would go from one expression to the other. Another one is then full of grace. And the next expression in, he said, well, you cannot say full of grace. What does it mean? That this is like full of beer, or full of cheese, and haven't eaten too much. And then he changes this entirely. And so this kind of attitude I would emphasize. Mm-hmm. And I would emphasize that philosophical literature, of course I had a good training in philosophy, a degree in philosophy, and I was able to teach Kant and Hegel and Nietzsche. I did teach it, but always try to go back to make this understandable. For instance, Kant, who is very abstract, philosopher of idealism, I would recommend the students to read his critiques in English. And I said, why can you recommend this? We are students of German. We are not prepared to read that stuff. And you say you read it in English. Well, you read it in German and in English, because in English it's clearer. Any kind, because the German language is complicated, like Latin, Greek, it's the construction of sentence, and these long long nouns, composita, they call them. In English, it's everything has to be clear, understandable. The one reason why English is so important in the as traffic language in the world, its clearness is simplicity. And if something has to be translated into English, it has to be simplified. That's quite a task to do this. Mm-hmm. But it is an important task. So topics like this were of great, great interest to me. And the other topic is then how the classics appear in modern thinking and early modern literature. That's usually the philosophy of the Greeks and the Romans, and also the symbolizing of the gods, what the gods meant. Apollo, for instance, when you go to a restaurant, to a special restaurant, you go to Dionysus here, and what do you expect? You expect a Greek restaurant with the specialty of wine. And some people get mixed up. If you go to a pub and you want to go next door to the liquor store, it's called Apollo. Apollo has nothing to do with with wine, but he's the brother of Dionysus, and so on. Take modern comic strips and so on. Always find some classicism in there, classical characters. Why is that? Well, probably consciously and unconsciously, the classics are still kind of an authority for us. The authority of tradition. If you can go that far back, yes. I dealt with the Dionysian then again, 68 to 72 or 4, when we had these revolutionary movements here on the universities. And a play developed in New York, Dionysus in 69. Mm-hmm. And then the myth of Dionysus was performed in the nude, of course. And then the performance was censured. Student papers, newspapers in Michigan and others, and here too, took it up and dealt with this. And even here, the Catholic Chapel tried to combine or did together the Eucharist, the sacrament of bread and wine, with Dionysus. And
I didn't know that.
Well, I could, one day I, a student gave it to me, gave the Sunday. What you call it, every Sunday that they put out some little bit of information, and which deals with the gospel of the day and what they're doing. And there it was. Not being aware of the historical reality that early Christianity was very, very much much endangered by Dionysian myths and mysteries. There were so much in common in the Roman army and so that it was a real fight of survival, and the Christian group was stronger. Saint Augustine still deals with this, and I found out things which, as a Christian, I didn't know at all. My topic was to follow that Dionysian Dionysus business up from the earliest Greek and pre-Greek revelations about this in literature to the Middle Ages up to modern times, up to Dionysus in 69. When I came to early Christianity, I also checked the church fathers. I found that three of them had belonged, they confess, they belonged to Dionysian mysteries. And they go so far and say, without the experience of the Dionysian mystery, when you eat the God and drink his blood, we wouldn't have a right of celebrating the real sacrament. That is, the celebration of communion in any of Christian churches is taken over from the Dionysian mysteries. And it's true when you read the Bible of the account of the last Thursday, you know, Christ institutes mm-hmm. the, and you have this beautiful picture by Leonardo da Vinci, you know, sitting there, the group there, and the one Judas on the side and crumbling the money and things like this. Well, that has to be transferred into a liturgical act in which the community, the believers, could participate. How to do this? And in the very, very beginning, the early Christians had meals. A meal, like Thanksgiving. Would come together and eat together and have something for the slaves who were poor and the rich ones. And that was also where they knew the rich and the poor together on an equal basis. And then, then the priest would have to say at some occasion, now I bless these bread and wine and then you eat Christ. And for them that was something understandable, because you had this in Roman religion of that time, Greek religion, Egyptian religion, Isis, Osiris and so on. And we don't have that anymore. So, but at the time of early Christianity, the ones who had come over from the mysteries, they introduced their rites and of course substituted whatever was Dionysus and so substituted with the Christian belief. And in the history of the church would never deal with this in the early centuries, with this closeness, because they considered it too dangerous. That was then the devil. Dionysus' devil goes on up to the 15th century. Interesting things.
That's really interesting.
To discover these.
Yeah. So when you go out and start your research, you have a general idea of the direction you're going in, but a lot of these things are
yes.
things that you just discover along the way,
yes.
along the route, which surprise you as much as...
Yes, it surprised me, and then they it raised my interest in, mm-hmm. then to go after these yeah. things. So, and be able to do that, that was the great, great advantage of, or is the great advantage of being in this profession. That your hobby is your profession. That's such a privilege. That it almost makes you feel guilty toward the one, when you then remember, like I did, my time in American factory working piecework. And these young women and young men have no outlook at all and have to go on and on to make a living. And you sit there at home, you move the country, that nobody disturbs you. And you get your research grants.
Let's talk about those.
The research grants.
Research grants, but I'm going to... Now you have this opportunity to do this research, to conduct this research, but you have some things behind that research, some support that you acquire from the university, I assume.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about research, the research funding, yes, as you experienced it during your career here at the university.
In the humanities and also in the sciences, the student who goes on in writing the dissertation, he needs time, half a year, where he can sit down and investigate and write. So he then gets a kind of an PhD or dissertation fellowship from the university. Almost every university does that. Without that, the first comprehensive writing of someone would be impossible. So the dissertation has been finished. The young professor has his first job, first position, and he knows and realizes he has to produce, publish or perish. And he is, of course, a young member of the profession. He's overloaded with teaching basic courses and other extracurricular activities, the German club, in mathematics, the connection to high schools and things like this. What to do? And then he is told, and he can read in Wisconsin Week or anywhere, about possibilities of applying for research. Applying to organizations mostly outside of the university. One great privilege of this university is that it has the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. And you and probably everybody knows that there are millions available every year because of the income from vitamin C, for instance, which has been developed here, or the most productive poison against rats and mice.
Warfarin, yeah.
Which is sold in Europe too. And so here you have already at your own university, you have these possibilities. How to get this? Every year there is, in the sciences and in the humanities, there are two committees of professors who have had research support, and usually from every field of expertise. And then you can apply for a scholarship. You can apply for a scholarship every third year. And your project, of course, not everybody can get a scholarship. Let's say about 40%, 30 to 40% are successful. So whatever you develop as your project will be in competition with others. Mm-hmm. And you have to learn, and nobody tells you how to do that, you have to learn to sell your project. Some are so successful in writing up projects and using most of their time in doing so that they get one fellowship after the other. Not necessarily from here, but from here, and then from Fulbright, and then Guggenheim, and so on and so on. Main part of my teaching, and also of what I'm doing right now, is helping young colleagues to write up projects. To write up projects, how to do this. And so I have then, with the help of, well, the first help I got from Ian Loram, who himself got very little research support, but he knew as a chairman as an associate, then later as associate dean, what are the important points? So my first appointment with the graduate school university was University of Kansas. And I got there, well, first I had a small one in Bowling Green, Ohio, in 1961. Then the next one is 1963, research fellowship in Kansas. And then in 1964, University of Kansas, second research fellowship. The same year, I was told, we had a guest professor from Germany at Kansas, and he told me, he would like me to teach a semester or a year at his university in Stuttgart, and possibly also teach not a full load, but get some research support. He said, we don't have too much money, but if you can get partial support, then we can arrange this. So he advised me to apply for a Fulbright lectureship connected with research. Well, that was the first application outside of the university. Probably wasn't too good because I was only an alternate. And mentioned this to that professor, and he returned to Stuttgart, and he knew some people on the German Fulbright committee. See, then Fulbright you have an of the American committee, and then in the guest land, you know, and they have to work together. So he put some pressure on them, I understand. And so in the last minute, it was granted. Mm. And of course, I learned from this. What did I wrong? What didn't I emphasize enough? The next year, while being in Germany, I applied for a grant from the American Philosophical Society. It was in 1965. Then I came to this university, and I got the first research grant from this university in 1966. 2 years later, I applied for a visiting professorship at the Institute. Mm-hmm. I was told that many colleagues would apply, and that I would have to expect that my application would be denied unless it is extremely good and important. So I didn't know. Of course, I had several possibilities. One dealing with the writer of Sturm und Tress and its early romanticism, Heinze, about whom I had written my dissertation, and I got a number of research grants before, or something on Martin Luther Reformation. But at that time, dealing with Reformation means religion and church, and that was nothing in. Mm-hmm.
And then that wasn't a popular thing to do.
No, it wasn't.
Popular things to do are important in determining what you apply for.
And then I thought, well, what about the Dionysian, the Dionysus? And I checked with the members, the permanent members of the Institute, who they were. There were two classicists and one medieval philosophy, and one medieval history, and then Germaine Brave, the only one dealing with something modern. And I thought, gosh, that Dionysian stuff, that would be the right thing. So I developed a project of trying to prove or to show how this Dionysian attitude was, what was taken over from the classical party and what was changed. And how was it done, particularly in Germany and a little bit in France? And I think because of this topic was close to the special field of these three professors, that made an important part. Well, when I got this, then I was told, yes, that's so. As a matter of fact, they showed me in writing that the letter inviting such applications and sent to the different chairman of the different departments indicates that a project close to the expertise of members of would be especially useful because that member could help the young guy in developing this.
Which is part of the purpose of the institute. Yeah.
So that was a great success. It was a great success to the extent that to my great, great surprise, 3 years later, I was selected to be a permanent member of that institute. And that these particular honors all got me by surprise. Because I never believed that I'm, let's say, great in this. Mm-hmm. I try to do my best, but I always believe I could have done better. Mm-hmm. And I found that's a very important negative attitude, because if you think that's great, then you're already mistaken. Yeah. And then it has been my experience with students, especially students in preparing for the PhD, the ones who are in constant state of fear are the best ones.
Mm. That's interesting.
That's another thing which I should mention, actually. I noticed pretty soon that almost half of the students who are candidates for the PhD don't make it. I was so shocked by this that I joined another professor in another discipline and we investigated with other universities how many percent. Nobody thinks that all that's humanities. What do you think, how many percent of candidates don't make it? 40%, 35 to 40%. Where do they stumble in the dissertation? I had only two cases that in two applicants who didn't make it to the preliminary examination. And then it was repeated and they still didn't make it. But these were native Germans. Mm. And because they speak German so well and can read it fluently, and they thought, well, that gives me a kind of an indication, almost a privilege, of getting a PhD in German. And that doesn't work, because you have to do independent, original, what you notice yourself. Mm-hmm. So, but all the others, they failed because they didn't make it through to the dissertation. And I think the general understanding nowadays is that the jump from writing papers for the end of the semester of 30, 40 pages to an independent and new investigation of book's length is too much. And most of them already start out getting in the wrong position. They read and read and read stuff that is important to the dissertation. And of course, the advisor tells them all kind of wonderful things. You have to read this and you read this. And then you come up with questions. Oh, yes, if you then take up that sideline. And when it comes to writing something, he has so much stuff. He doesn't know how to put this down and to get it organized. That's the reason that, at least in the humanities, in the last 15 years, I guess, they have developed dissertation committees. That's not only one advisor, but two or three, and they follow the candidate by let them develop, let's say, an outline, and then they say, well, no, you go ahead and start with chapter one, or, and then you turn it in, and we talk about this. That can be of great help. It doesn't help in every case, and it can easily prolong the study.
How does what you learned about what was happening in America differ from what the normal process is in Germany? Is it as big a problem there as it is here?
Well, it's not as big a problem. First of all, no university on the continent, it is German, Italian, French, and so I exclude the British, because the British have determined our studies here, our way of studying. No university asks for a kind of a preliminary examination where you have to reproduce the whole field in writing and in all exams and so on. It is. It was very difficult, very hard for me. The only good thing was, which I, when I got my degree, came to Bowling Green, and wherever you go, you have to teach any kind of course in your field. Mm-hmm. I had to teach modern stuff. And then I even had to teach French. And that was an ordeal, in spite of the fact that I was fairly fluent in French. So you are prepared, you have your notes on your preliminary examination. Yeah, in Europe, you have an exam on the period or movement of which you have selected one particular topic. Let's say you write about Nietzsche. So your kind of preliminary. No, you don't have a preliminary exam. You start to write with the help of your advisor, called Dr. Vater, which he usually is in that respect that he is overbearing. You know, your dissertation, the Dr. Vater, your advisor, thinks your dissertation is okay, then committee is developed in two more readers, and then they say, oh yes, that's okay, or this and this could be changed. And then the candidate has to defend the thesis, and at the same time has to show that he is familiar with the period. That is, for Nietzsche, that would be then, with the philosophy and the literature of that time, the political situation with the around 1870 German-American war and the coming of a nationalism of Germany, how this is then also reflected in literature and philosophy. That's six exam of 1.5 hours. That's all. So I think we are overdoing this. But still going on.
Yeah.
The only relief is that you don't have to, no matter what your topic is in, what your field, that you have to show that you are fluent in reading and understanding two foreign languages. But when I got here, the very first year, they did have a pre-qualifying exam for somebody who wanted to go to a PhD. And it has two topics, which of course were close to my heart, but impossible or very hard for any candidate. They were checked on Shakespeare, or three topics, Shakespeare, the classics, and the Bible. And I recall in the first few weeks that the executive committee had gotten together and then after a long discussion decided to do away with this. It was very helpful, but for the candidate to study this, but it's too much. You cannot be fully prepared when you take your PhD and you get your dissertation. You are not even fully prepared when you're getting tenure. You have to grow, and that's the reason why publish or perish. And so unfortunate sounds, and so exaggerating it is basically necessary.
As a way of continued development. Yeah.
As you probably had, two professors who would teach the same every year, and a certain joke would come at a certain time, and from predecessors to him taking that course, you were expecting already that kind of a joke this week. And I recall one professor, in linguistics, was very good and very helpful to me. He had a book of that size. And he opened it up, and it was very small. Then he would continue to lecture on his subject. So you cannot teach with whatever you have so well prepared at the beginning of your teaching and then go on and on and on for years. It's impossible.
Getting back for a moment to research funding, did you find your funding adequate here
at Yes.
your stay in Madison?
I found it adequate, and because, first of all, I had good self-training in conceiving projects, and not far-fetched projects, but the ones which are helpful in my career, which leads to publications. Mm-hmm. So, secondly, the arrangement of university graduate school fellowships is something very, very great. For the last 10 or 15 years, we for the first time developed what many other schools have, and also in Europe, the sabbatical year or semester. And up to that time, the explanation here was, we don't offer you a sabbatical, but you, for every 50 years or so, or later, but you can apply for a research fellowship every third year. Every third year. So that you have fellowship, then you have nothing, and then apply again. And I found this very good. Mm-hmm. And I think that the sabbatical leave doesn't, well, I'm pretty sure it doesn't bring as much result as this kind of arrangement with graduate school fellowships. Because the professor, first of all, feels he can take it easy. And then he has made up something, he would develop a new course. Or you can do that in 2-3 days. You know, develop a curriculum for a new course. You know, you go to the library and you go to the material. So, but this is very, very important. And then the possibilities of applying. So after I had become a permanent member of the institute, which meant that I would teach only half a load. And we would try to teach a full load one semester and then get the second semester free. And for obvious reasons, the deans would always fight that. You know, then they want you to be on campus. So, but once in a while, it would help. But I still, most of my research had to be done in Germany. So you had to go there, live there for a certain while. And that means additional expenses, the flight, living there. And you take your wife along, so she cannot sit here all by herself. But she has nothing to do with your project, even if she helps you. You kind of deduct it from the taxes and so on. So I would then apply to organizations in Europe. The German Academic Exchange Service in 1975, and then a study society for cultural relations to East and Central Europe in 1976, the International Archive for Social History of German Literature, of which I then became a board member. The next in 1977. Well, in 1977, I had three research grants. A stipend from a library in Wolfenbüttel, which has all the works on early printed materials up to the Enlightenment. A library founded by a duke who had enough money. And then, of course, the Germans did away with the nobility, and it was taken over by the state, and it's then open to everyone. It's now an international research center, and many colleagues from other fields in humanities have been there, have been granted, and stay using the Volkswagen offers several millions every year. So that helped. And I had a university grant and a stipend from this library. And I gave a few lectures there. They liked it and they continued this into the next semester. As soon as you become known, and then these things fall to you practically. And the same is with publication. The first book to get that published is usually very, very difficult. The moment you have that book published and you prepare the next one with another publisher, they just take notice that you have a book published, they don't care anymore. Okay, then publish it. It has to be supported anyhow, the publication in this field. You don't make any money, not a cent, on all these publications, only six books. As a matter of fact, you need financial support from the department or the institute or from another organization, because the publisher doesn't take any chances anymore. They publish everything. That's why you have the flood of so many books now. You can get the worst and poorest dissertation published if you can, nowadays, you can put down $5,000. And they tell beginning faculty colleagues, say, well, can you spare $2,000? Then you have the dissertation published, then you have the first book. And maybe, and then if the department can, it supports them, or the university. And that's usually the end of the publication career. Because what the young colleague, what he has is only that state of fear and anxiety he went through in order to get the dissertation out. And he just cannot do it again. He never learned how to write a longer treatise or a book. Mm-hmm. That's a failure.
That's really a shame. Yes, I know some people in that boat.
Yeah. So I, from there on, my whole, the 25 years, 22 years, as a faculty member, I were very, very lucky. I have to be very, very grateful. And without these opportunities, I wouldn't have developed to this kind of. And then also the recognition you have then worldwide. You all of a sudden you see yourself invited to Canada. I was invited to Italy, to Yugoslavia, to East Germany.
To present lectures on your work.
And to stay there for a week. And I didn't know whether I should accept that. I did. And then, and I was the whole stay, I had a lady who had nothing to do than just to take care of me. Where I would give a lecture, where I would eat, where I would sleep. And I said, well, are you my shadow? She said, no. But she was. But I could ask her all kinds of questions. I said, why did your government invite me? Well, you have been writing about the Reformation and conditions in cities, in early city, the Hansa city of Braunschweig, I dealt with. And you have taken, you were always very interested in the social conditions and investigated them, but you always indicated also that you're not following our line. We don't want to convince you, but we want to show you what we...
In some of our earlier discussions before today, including today, we've mentioned the Institute for the Humanities, and you said that you were a visiting scholar there, you applied for and you became a visiting scholar in what year was that, 70?
In 72.
72. And then you became a permanent member?
Then 3 years later I was appointed.
How did you get appointed a permanent member?
At that time, and even today, and also today, the number of, at that time, permanent members, nowadays senior members for 5 years, only the permanent, the status of permanence has been given up, and I think that's good. Mm-hmm. Nobody has to sit there until he dies, you know. Has been that you can have five members, permanent members. That's all the graduate school can support, because half of the salary of these permanent members came from the graduate school and the other half from the College of Letters and Science, for their teaching. Mm-hmm. But since they only are teaching half of the load, so they can only expect half of the salary. Well, the one member had died, a philosopher and historian, a medieval historian, Julius Weinberg, one whom I admire very, very much. I met him at Logos in Slokos, mm-hmm. in my first meeting, and he approached me and asked me about Goethe's drama Faust, said a little bit, and then he started to ask me whether I could give that quotation in German, and I gave it. Then he said, well, that is of course literal, it's not word for word, and then he went on and recited Faust, and I was standing there, blurry. It is foreigner, it's American. He teaches me to recite Faust. Well, a few years afterwards, he passed away. So that means one position free. Then I understand that every department in humanities can, or supposed to, name, if they want to name a candidate. Not every department does that. They might just feel they don't have one at this moment. So the department I was away, and I didn't know what they were doing. So I had again one of my research grants, and so I don't actually know whether the executive committee had decided to nominate me, or whether I think they had to. But it's possible that, see, at that time, Ian Loram was chairman and also associate dean. And I have the suspicion that he indicated to the department they should nominate me. I'm hesitant to say this because I know that that the left wing of our department would not be very much in favor of this. So I don't know how this worked out. And then they decided they would nominate me without telling me. Hmm. But they have the letters of reference, of course, and things. So at that semester before that time, I had an offer from the University of Massachusetts, and I went there for an interview. And for that reason, I told them that I would be interested. See, I thought I had to, I might have to get out of medicine to change. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then they asked for letters of recommendation and an evaluation of my scholarly and things. So they had them on hand. And I went there for an interview. I liked it very much. I liked the scenery very much. The state of Massachusetts is lovely. Mm-hmm. But the professional representation was much lower than here. So I gave that idea up. And then had all these letters of recommendation on my file, mm-hmm. with the placement bureau, I guess. So they took these letters and added them to the nomination application of the department. That's all they had. Mm-hmm. I came back in the summer, and then all of a sudden it was announced.
Were you surprised?
Again, and I asked my colleagues, and I asked the chairman. They would give me some kinds of answers. Yeah. Why am I asking? I'm glad that you, and it's good for the department too. So that was a great change.
After being at the Institute as long as you have been, and having a chance to think back on things. What do you think it was? Obviously, I mean, I'm assuming there were several other very qualified people nominated, yes, for that position. What was it about you and your background that led them to choose you, do you think?
Again, since I don't estimate myself so high, I think they had come to know me as a person, as a scholar, because I 3 years before I was there as a visiting professor. And see, when you are invited as a visiting professor, you discuss your project on luncheon meeting. You also give a paper about your progress, a public paper. And then I used the opportunity very much. I asked everyone about questions I had. I did not hesitate. And I think the attitude of many scholars to be alone, to be loners, you know, to do their thing and then have no connection to the others, is something I never could understand.
I was going to mention the breadth of your research, because you really talk about philosophy, you talk about history, and in relation to literature. It's not a narrow topic.
No,
it's a very broad topic. And just from the title, Institute for the Humanities, you would think that they might want something that was
well
broader than usual.
see the, every year the Institute would have four visiting scholars from this university and four from the outside, selected from a great number of applications. And their projects, most of the individual projects, were strictly a part of their special field. And this is a double specialization already, a special field and then a part of this. So the Institute saw this as an opportunity to expose the individual scholar to getting advice or discussing this with others, because they don't do this. Mm-hmm. When I had become an assistant professor and had put out my first article, you get off-prints. And I didn't know what to do with these 30 off-prints. I sent them to a few friends. And then I had received off-prints from others. And they would say, they would give you that article, that's always, and they would write down with compliments, Fritz so-and-so, and put it in your mailbox. Ian Lorham did this. So I went to Ian, when you were in Kansas, and said, why do you put this in, why don't you give it to me? Do you have time to talk a little bit about this? I think it's interesting. Well, I don't think there's anything to talk about. And I could see he wasn't comfortable with this idea. Then we, after a while, we talked about it. Then we came to the conclusion that it's like a chicken laying an egg. Put it there somewhere, and somebody will find it. There is no communication. There's no communication. Or when I wanted to ask a member of the department, do you have time that you can tell me a little bit about, let's say, Nietzsche from your socialist point of view? Well, what about tomorrow after 2:30? So I would come there after 2:30, and he would give me good information, solid information. Listening, interesting, you know, Americans are very polite, nice people. Then I could see after 15 minutes, I would have gone on. That was actually all. So I thanked him and then went away. Well, it could have been a continuing, he could have told me more about his research and so. That I found in Logos, and that was organized, part of the organization of the Institute. But most of them, I must say, did not take this opportunity to a full extent, to the full parts, full potential. Because the American professor in general is a loner. He does his thing and in his laboratory or in his study and puts it out, and he's glad if it's read and is discussed. He even likes it that it's criticized. But there is no continuous dialogue. Mm-hmm. And that's not good. It's not good for the academic community, and it's certainly not good for the individual. The great merit of the Institute was, has been, and still is, that every year, four or five professors, colleagues from this university, from the humanities, join the Institute. And they are invited to continue to come. Some of them do this for a little while. But the most important thing for them is they have time and possibility to do their own thing, unfortunately, mm-hmm. Yes. But it's important for their career.
What kind of a role does the director of the Institute play?
He's a primus inter pares, that is, he has no strong authority. First of all, he doesn't deal with money. He doesn't deal with promotion, so he is practically, well, he's just there in answering questions or in signing some things. The important person is Loretta Feilings, the secretary. Mm.
Tell me a little bit about her.
She has been with the Institute from the beginning. She was the secretary of the first director. He was the same at that time, the chairman of the Department of History of Science, Gasset, I forget the name. And so she then was taken over by them. She was a young woman at that time. And she developed an interest in what was going on around her. She joined the Archaeological Society, became the secretary of the society. She has guided research trips to Greece and Turkey, and I think 15 times or so.
Oh my.
She's not only good in these technicalities, but she also is, she knows Greek, modern Greek. She learned it all. And she has a library of arts, of books on arts, because we know that's it's a particular interest. So every Christmas she gets a big book on art. Mm-hmm. So, and she has become knowledgeable without any degrees. Mm-hmm. And she is the motor at the Institute. She tells actually in a very decent way. She's not like that former secretary in the German department.
Yes.
she restricts herself, and then she makes recommendations. And then the director only has to say, well, we have to renew our writing to get to invite fellows, and then she does it. She prepares. And she also prepares the symposia. Since 1974 or 5, the Institute gives 2 symposia a year. And it's paid for by a grant from a benefactor, a family, and a husband and wife. And so that is, there's enough money that a member or a visitor of the Institute can organize this symposium as a part of his own interest in field. And he can invite scholars from abroad, here.
That's wonderful.
It's all paid for. And then usually the results are published. There, the Institute cannot help, but the university press or other university press helps. It's also very good. But looking at my department, I must say that almost every colleague in philology and literature was able to spend a semester at the Institute. And that is great. And I think this is also true of the other departments, humanities departments.
That's very impressive, yeah.
That's very impressive.
What an opportunity.
Yeah.
Has it always been, as long as you've been here, has it been at Washburn Observatory?
Yes. When you come to the Institute and tell us about the oral history, and I think that one result should be that you should have a project of oral history dealing with the Institute as such, mm-hmm. and that you can talk and you can interview the directors, the former directors and the present, mm-hmm. and interview one or two of the, a number of the permanent members, 2 or 3, and then of course Loretta Feilings.
Yes, that sounds like a wonderful idea. Well, maybe we should end at that point when
you're
passing the buck to me.
Yeah, that's right.
To the history of the Institute. This is Barry Tyker. We're ending our interview now.